This is the Retirement and IRA Show for October 17th, 2015, Part 1.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. My name is Chris Stein. I'm a certified financial planner and a finance instructor at Colorado State University. And I am joined here in studio with Peter Scott Esquire, our resident estate planning attorney.
Good morning.
Good afternoon and good evening, all of the above. This is, in fact, a live recorded show, as we like to call it. We are recording this show on October 13th in the afternoon. This show will play live on October 17th, and you'll also be able to listen to it later, streaming in the normal places on iTunes and on our website at theretirementandiraShow.com. There is one absentee member of the show, Jim Saulnier, who's normally here with us, almost always.
Yeah,
he actually is related to the show, is meeting with someone on the phone from a caller from New York, who I believe must, I don't think the radio signal reaches quite that far, but they stream the show. I'm not sure if it's on iTunes or live streaming from the radio station, but in either case, they had a somewhat urgent issue to discuss with Jim, so he had to step out here for the beginning of the show. He will be joining us, assuming things go as planned, in the second segment. So this first segment is just Peter and myself. Once again, this is the Retirement and IRA Show, where we talk about topics related to retirement and IRAs.
Wow, what a coincidence.
I know. To include estate planning, which Peter's been kind enough to join us these past several months to kind of add a new twist to the show that we haven't really had before.
Well, and the retirement and IRA accounts are integral to the estate planning. Because very often there's a balance in those plans that people want to leave to their children, their heirs, and they come under very technical rules that are easily violated with disastrous financial consequences as a result, with 50% penalties and so forth. Yeah. So
disastrous unless you like to send money, unneeded or unrequired money, to the federal government for taxes and penalties.
Yeah, well, sure. And they certainly need the money the right, way they're spending it. Yeah. So maybe that's not such a bad thing for them, but not good for your family.
No, no. So last week, we actually had another guest with us, Jan Lord, who is also an estate planning attorney, but who focuses her practice on elder law, dealing with Medicaid issues and long-term care issues and that sort of thing, and that, again, just an added topic to some of the things we discuss here on the show. Yep. If you have a question based on last show, don't hesitate to contact us, and we will get that information, get that message over to Jan. But as it so happens, I believe we received an email.
We did.
From last show that Peter, of course, since he's here regularly, is going to try to tackle for us. Do you have that email?
Yep, I do, and it actually was sort of adds on to what Jan was talking about the last 2 weeks that she was on the air, and it's something that I've encountered in my practice from time to time. I don't actively practice in the elder law area. I usually work with Jan on that, but this is a situation that has arisen before, so I am familiar with it. So rather than drag Jan in without warning, I thought we could just go ahead and work through it ourselves. So.
Well, before you read that, I know that email came in to your email. Maybe so people know how to do this, so they might think, well, wow, I'd love to have them answer my question. How would they get a hold of you, Peter, if they had another estate planning related question?
Well, they can reach me, as this listener did, through peterscotthelps.com. That's peterscotthelps.com. A little long, but it's peterscotthelps.com, and that will put you right into my webpage where you can ask your questions, send an email from there. Or if you want to use the old-fashioned way and call, actually talk to someone, more than happy to do that. And the Greeley number is 970-339-3500. That's 970-339-3500. And I'm with the law offices of Cohen, Payton, and Payne. We have offices in Greeley. We have offices in Fort Collins and in Denver. That number will connect you to me regardless of where I am. I can run, but I can't hide. And so they'll find me. And my practice is limited to estate planning, business succession planning, and transactions and tax matters. And the firm itself practices in the area of business transactions, banking, of course, estate planning and tax, intellectual property, copyrights, trademarks, those sorts of things. Real estate, real strong real estate practice, oil and gas. And so we've got a pretty general transactional business-oriented practice and also working with individuals in those same areas. So feel free to call us and let us know if we can help in any way.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a question regarding some of the other topics we cover, say your retirement accounts, your IRAs or 401ks or annuities. We do a lot of annuity investigation work here where people might own such a thing and forgot why they bought it or how it actually works. And we do what's called an annuity consultation or annuity call where we'll help you figure out exactly what you've got there and if it provides you what you're looking for. And so those types of topics can be directed to our website at jimhelps.com is the easiest way to get there. Of course, there's the retirementandiraShow.com, but that's kind of long. It'll get you there, but jimhelps.com is the shortest version. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you'll find the Contact Us button, and then you can just send us a message and include some contact info, and we'll be happy to reach out to you, either Jim or Justin or myself or whoever is appropriate to answer your particular question will get a hold of you. And we might, you know, with your permission, if your question seems to be something that can help others in our listening audience, we might do what we're about to do here, which is actually answer the question on the air. So that brings us to the email we received, or did you receive this week, Peter? What have you got?
I'll just read it. It said, the first caller, George, said, I'm not wealthy, but I very much want to leave my house to my children. I'm in good health now, but I'm concerned that I may get sick later before I die and have to go into a nursing home. How can I protect my house for my kids and leave it to them? Common question. And Jan was talking last Saturday about folks really do want to leave something to their children. Mm-hmm. And very often it is the house. That's something where a lot of the time the kids were raised in that house. And so the parents really do want to leave them something. They may not be as concerned about their investments, that sort of thing, if it has to be used or depleted for purposes of taking care of them prior to death. But very often the house is a special asset with a lot of emotion attached to it, and consequently a lot of people like to preserve that. Plus it has a lot of equity built up in it very often for our older folks who have been paying on their mortgage and may have paid it off, so it's owned free and clear. So it's a real nice asset to pass to the children.
Mm-hmm. So it's the type of asset, may or not be related directly to their question, but it's the type of an asset too that has an advantage in that step up in basis that we've talked about before. So there's kind of an avoidance of possible taxes, although, of course, there's a fairly high tax exclusion for gains on your personal residence in the tax code right now. But really, any more with expensive as some houses have gotten, that is one way for someone when they inherit it to essentially avoid any taxes on the gains that have happened maybe over decades as that house increased in value.
Sure, and of course it's become, with the exemption being in excess of $5 million, close to $5.5 million each, that knocks 99.7% out of us out of the estate tax. sort of area where we have to be concerned about that. But it really becomes more of an income tax issue
right.
for those folks with less than the $5+ million of assets. So what Chris was talking about, if that house was given to the children now while the parent is alive, then the children then receive that asset, but they also receive the parent's income tax basis. And because it's not their primary residence, they don't have the $250,000 or $500,000 gain exemption on the sale of a residence. So there can be a significant income tax impact on gifting property. So our caller is very wise, our emailer is very wise in suggesting that they want to leave the house to their children at their death. I'm sure mm-hmm. they don't want to vacate the house yet anyway. But they want to leave it to the children at death. So there's several ways, at least a couple of ways to do that, which we'll get into. But the house is something that we see people wanting to preserve and protect very mm-hmm. often. So one of the things, just backing up a little bit to understand the rules, is that when someone has expended their money and they get their what they call countable resources, as Jan was talking about, basically everything down to under $2,000, and they meet the income limit, then they can qualify for Medicaid, which the state then pays for their long-term care in a nursing home, skilled nursing. The house is exempt from qualifying. So very often someone may say that the threshold is $2,000. If they spent all of their other assets down and all they have in the bank is $2,000 in their house, they can qualify for Medicaid. And so that's fine, but what happens is that Medicaid then will put a lien on their house so that after they pass away, assuming that there's no other, there's not a surviving spouse in the house, they'll put a lien on it. And so when that house is sold, then Medicaid is repaid from the proceeds of the sale. Now, the kids, of course, it passing to them at the parent's death, they don't have any gain on the sale of the house because of the step-up in basis, but they will lose a substantial part of the proceeds, if not all of the proceeds, as a result of having to repay Medicaid or social services.
Right, and if the goal was for them not just to receive it to sell it, but actually receive the house to maybe retain it because it has this emotional attachment or a place for maybe family to meet or vacation in or whatever the circumstances might be, the intent might be to literally have the kids keep the home. And if there's this issue with Medicaid that's been, you know, the attached lien there, then the kids are in a position of having to scrape up money to pay back Medicaid to avoid the forced sale of the home.
Yeah, it could very well. Yeah, and that's obviously, if they wanted to preserve it, that's what they'd have to do. And that may mean that they have to borrow money. And mm-hmm. depending on how long the parent was in the nursing home, my mother was in skilled nursing for 7 years. Fortunately, she had long-term care insurance, so that helped. And so we were able to support her in that. And, of course, she didn't have any real estate at the time. But nonetheless, it's a pretty big price, $6,000-$8,000 a month for skilled mm-hmm. nursing.
So when the emailer is asking you that, how can they protect it with the concern, they named it specifically that they might have to go into nursing home care, we kind of surmised that they were going down this path of how can we protect the home so that this issue with Medicaid or being forced to utilize the equity in the home to ultimately pay for the medical care costs or nursing home costs, how can we avoid that or protect the home from that so it will pass cleanly to the children?
Well, the easy solution, and a lot of people avail themselves of this, is just to give the house to the kids. And that works. The only problem is that it has to be done 5 years before mm-hmm. the parent applies for Medicaid. There's what they call a 5-year look back. So when someone applies for Medicaid, they have to disclose on the application any transfers, what they say, for less than full and adequate consideration. Basically, if they gave it away and didn't sell it or didn't sell it at fair market value, then they have to disclose that. And the penalty period, it doesn't mean that they would not otherwise be eligible for Medicaid. They just incur this penalty period that is calculated by dividing the amount that was given away by the average nursing home care cost for that particular community. So let's just use our example. Say it costs $7,000 a month $7,000 a month for the long-term care. a house is worth $210,000, no loan against it, so we divide 7 into the 21. And so, Chris, do the math on that. What is that?
30 months.
30 months that they would not receive Medicaid support. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't have any other resources, what they've spent everything else down to $2,000, then that burden's going to fall on the children.
Right. So that's how they offset that in your example, Peter, the $210,000 gift that was given away. Medicaid can't force you to take it back. It's already been given. They can't unwind the thing. But where they penalize you is they essentially say, you're on your own until you, out of your own pocket, has spent all the money that you effectively gave away. Because Medicaid would have been able to take that home as compensation for us paying for your nursing home care in this particular instance. So you've got 30 months, which is 2.5 years worth of medical expenses, nursing home expenses that Medicaid's not going to help you with as a result of this particular gift if it was done within the 5-year look back.
Right. So, and it's from the date that the application is submitted. So, and that's when the penalty period, it used to be the penalty period ran from the date of the gift, and a number of years ago the law changed and it used to also be a 3-year look back period for that. The law changed it where the penalty runs from the date that the Medicaid application is submitted. So if they applied for Medicaid 4 years and 11 months after the date of the gift, the 7-year period would run from the date that the application was filed, which is almost 5 years after the gift was made. Mm-hmm. However, if they applied for Medicaid 5 years and 1 month after the gift was made, they don't have to disclose it. And the reason is it doesn't have any impact on their qualification. So, and if someone finds themselves in that situation and they want to keep the house, they can give it to the kids, and then the kids are going to have to then pay for the long-term care for the period of time until they get past the 5 years, which is a good solution if that the skilled nursing facility need is not identified until maybe sometime after 4 years. So that's not so bad. It can be very expensive. The problem with that is giving it to the kids is that house now is owned by the kids. Mm-hmm. And if a child has a business failure, then all of their assets are exposed, including the house, which could be then foreclosed on and sold by a creditor. Or if they go through a divorce, could be subject to the divorce. Of course, typically gifts are excluded from marital property, but any increase in the value of the gifts during the term of the marriage would be included. And because of the configuration of the assets, the house could be in jeopardy just because there was nothing else to satisfy that obligation that the divorce court imposes. And any number of sort of calamities that may befall a child can get in and mess up the ability for the house to remain in the children's name. So very often we recommend a trust as a vehicle. So if the property is held in trust for the children, that is, the house goes into an irrevocable trust, and there's a completed gift, that is, mom and dad give up the house and put it into the trust, then they've essentially relinquished themselves of it. That's the date of the gift. The trust is set up to run for mom and dad's life. And so if one of the children has a lawsuit or a divorce because they don't own it, the trust owns it, and they don't have a right to it until after mom and dad are gone, that affords the protection of the house for the remainder of mom and dad's life.
Mm-hmm. So that won't avoid the 5-year issue that we discussed before.
That's right.
Because there's still a gift happening of the home. It just happens to be being gifted to the trust rather than to the kids directly. So if you end up needing this Medicaid assistance within the 5 years from that date, you could run into that same entanglement issue with the penalty period being deployed. But if you could make it past the 5 years, now the house is held within the protections that is the trust, ultimately to be transferred to the kids upon the demise of the parents, mm-hmm. if the trust is written in such a way. But during the time of the parents' lives, it's not exposed to the creditors or financial issues that the children might undergo.
Yes, exactly.
That's the point there?
Yeah, and I wonder, some people will think that and recall that there used to be a three-year look-back period for transfer to the children directly, but if it went to a trust, it was a five-year look-back period. The change in the law changed everything to 5 years, so there's no disadvantage to going to the trust. One of the things I might point out, though, in having done this and worked with Jan Lord on it, is if you put name one of the children as a trustee on the trust, then you cannot name them or should not name them as your agent under your financial power of attorney. Apparently, the HICFA, or HICPUF, I've forgotten what the acronym pronunciation is, but the folks that administer the Medicaid take the position that if the trustee also is the agent under the power of attorney for the parent, somehow that's tied back to the parent and the gift is not complete and that asset, the house, namely, in the trust is still available, and then that would not protect it. So you have to be very careful about making sure that the trustee of the trust for the house is different than the agent under the financial power of attorney. And that was something that I was totally unaware of because it's so contrary to our law. Mm-hmm. But apparently that's the position that social services or whoever administers Medicaid is taking. And so, yes, we may be able to win, but that's a lawsuit and tens of thousands of dollars later. And this caller had mentioned they're not wealthy, and most people aren't at that point, certainly. And they don't have the funds or the resources to be able to fight the state on that type of position. So
now, will the kids, if the home transfers in kind of this two-step manner, which is to the trust first while the parents are living, and then ultimately from the trust to the kids, I guess it could be held within the trust even after the parents have passed, but if it, after the parents' death, do the kids still benefit from a step-up in basis, or does this negate that advantage to that type of an asset?
They do not, because it's a gift, and of course the gift carries the parents' basis, and that's the downside. Mm-hmm. That's the price that's paid for this.
For the protection. That's just kind of the, I guess if you want to think of it as the cost of the, I hate to use the I word, because it's not insurance, but if mm-hmm. you want to think of it as a protection as similar to insurance, to protect your home against you having issues where it might be taken in a Medicaid clawback, or if you have you don't want to expose it to the kids' creditors, there's a price to be paid for that protection. You lose the step-up. And you also, there's some cost to setting up the trust as well. Not
yes.
exorbitant, but
no.
but there'd be some cost there as well.
I think there is a possibility, and I don't recall in the one that I worked with Jan on if we did it, but certainly from a tax law standpoint, we can move it into an irrevocable trust, have it be outside of their estate. That is, they've given up the control and yet have it be taxed to them and included in their estate at death, because what we have here is we have state law that operates independent of federal tax law. And the federal tax law says basically if the house is included in their estate for tax purposes, that it will get the step up in basis. But they may have given up full control and ownership of that particular house. And as a consequence, it may satisfy, well, would satisfy the Medicaid application rules, but may not satisfy the completed gift rules of the Internal Revenue Code. And whether we can get away with that would be a good question for Jan next time we have her on. And I don't know the answer to
that.
So
that'd be a little nuance there where I guess leave it. There's a crack in the door possibly of getting the protection and maintaining the step-up in basis at death. And maybe that's something we can revisit in the future.
Well, I think what I'll do is I'll check with Jan, and then next week we'll come back. Maybe we can tag on and get an answer.
Perfect.
We walked right into our own question.
Excellent. I like when our answers generate new questions.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
So we're coming to the end of this first segment here. As always, when we come back from each segment, we're going to play a little musical tribute to a connection to Social Security. In this first break, when we come back, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 80 years ago. That would be back in 1935. When we come back from the break after that, we'll hear a song from 1975, which is 40 years ago, and then Coming into the last segment, we'll hear the number one song from 1980 or 35 years ago. Each one of those numbers has a tie into Social Security, where Social Security was started 80 years ago. And then they initially used 40 elapsed years in their initial calculation for your primary insurance amount, which is the dollar amount that you are paid at your full retirement age for your retirement benefit. And then the most modern number that we focus on is the 35-year number, which brings us to 1980. That 35 best earnings years are used in your calculation to set your full retirement age benefit. So with all that being said, the hint for the number one song, or at least a top song, we don't have the number one song from 1935, but this song is about, quote, "A life without romance is a life that's sad."
So I guess I would agree with that. Lesson.
Yeah. So we'll hear a song related to that particular topic. So I guess we'll be right back after this break.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. We're listening to one of the very top songs of 80 years ago. That would be 1935, for those of you doing the math at home. My name is Chris Stein, a certified financial planner and a finance instructor at Colorado State University. And I'm here with Peter Scott, and Jim Saulnier is also joining us.
Jim has joined us.
He has. He wasn't here for the first segment.
I was not. And good afternoon, good morning.
Good morning, good evening, good day. All that stuff.
Good day.
So, I'm not
Australian
even. Should I let you guess on what the name of that song was? Or?
Well, I can tell from the words that I don't know.
Right. There are actually words to this song, but they don't start singing it until a full minute and a half.
Oh my gosh!
The song. So it's kind of a combination instrumental and then some singing later on. So we're not going to wait for that to happen. But that is "Chasing Shadows," performed by the Dorsey Brothers. And it was a popular song written by two very successful but lesser-known artists of the era, lyricist Benny Davis and composer Abner Silver. Abner went on to compose songs that have been performed by many major vocalists through the 40s and 50s, Rudy Valli, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Mel Torme, and Elvis Presley, to name a few.
Wow. And a very successful career.
Exactly. So we take a look at that, or at least we don't look at it. We take a listen to that as we come in to kind of honor the beginning of Social Security, which was 80 years ago this year. So back in 1935, the Social Security system that we know began to take effect. So in our lead up to an update on what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, which will come in the fourth segment, we kind of do an audio tribute to the beginning of Social Security. So, Jim, since you've joined us now, we had Peter and I discussed an email question received from last week regarding protection of a residence to be able to pass on to children if someone was worried about the exposure of that residence to nursing home care expenses and Medicaid issues. So we covered
that. This would have been good for Jan.
Well, actually, it was prompted by Jan being on the show. I had a question, and Chris, too, at the tail end of that I'm going to check with Jan and report back next week.
Excellent. Very good.
So do you have any glorious updates for us? How's your week been going, Jim?
It's Tuesday.
Yes. How is it so far?
Very good.
Saturday. It's been several days.
It has been since we last met, but no, things are going good. Been a nephew update. He decided not to move.
Oh. Move back or to move out here?
Oh, no, he moved back because he was ready to get the hell out of my house. I wasn't going to tolerate it anymore.
I thought he was renting an apartment in Westminster or somewhere.
Broomfield. Yes. No, he did not. He didn't sign the lease. He had until Saturday of last week to sign the lease, and he didn't.
Couldn't pull the trigger?
No. So it took 6 weeks of sitting at my house doing nothing to realize he doesn't want to move.
What about his friend that was with him that really did want to move?
Well, his friend really can't move without his help.
I see.
So his friend's not going to move either.
I see.
But I've got my house back.
So what was the Was there one thing in particular? That, did he miss lobster? Or what?
what was the...
I think, honestly, what it is, he just isn't mature yet. And he said he would miss home. He misses, as my mom and I say, he would miss the comfort and security of home. He has it easy. I don't want to get into the parenting issues of him. But let's just say he pays... if you had two choices of little or no rent, he pays one of those. I'll let you choose which one he pays in order to stay at my sister's house. And I do remember at one point in time when they were contemplating moving and they're looking at the cost of rent out here, he did turn to his friend and say, man, well, I won't say the exact language he used, but it was something defective. Man, it stinks having to pay to live somewhere.
Yeah, it does stink. I agree.
So I think they just did their own version of quick math and realized living with their parents at 24. Mm-hmm. I tried to embarrass him even into moving. Mm-hmm. There was a cute waitress
and
at one of
work.
The right. Well, one of the restaurants where we were in Denver. There was a very cute waitress working there around his age, and I said to her when he was sitting there, I said, "Hey, let me ask you something. Would you date someone who still lives with their mom?" And she looked directly at Evan and said, "You still live with your mom?"
And then he was okay with that.
It didn't embarrass him. So anyways, he's not moving, which is too bad. I needed help this fall cleaning up my yard, so I'll have to find.
And you think that he might have been a candidate for that?
I don't know. But his guns are locked in my gun safe, and I could easily have changed the combo and said, "Hey, help me with my leaves, or I'm not going to open up the gun safe."
Well, that may happen yet.
But I wish him the best. He's a good kid. He's 24. He just... I don't quite get to this generation, but he's got a little bit more maturing to do. The frontal lobe part of his head probably hasn't fully developed yet. So I guess he'll continue to live at home, rent-free, and in time move on with his life and hopefully find something that he wants to do. But he's
good luck to him.
6 weeks here of living with his uncle, trying to figure out what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like he's not a lot closer, but at least he eliminated one thing, moving to Colorado.
Yes.
That's one step in the right direction.
Yeah.
But he does like it here. He just was worried he wasn't going to like it enough to move here. And anyway, so that's up with that. And of course, everybody knows I am back from the FPA meet. We didn't talk about that much last week. So lots of good information that we discovered at the FPA meeting. I know we're going to talk a little bit about an RMD issue here. But
the FPA stands
for Financial Planning Association. I'm sorry. That's right. I act like everybody listening knows what we're talking about. So I was in Boston 2 weeks ago. So I left. Evan stayed in my house in Colorado with his friend, took care of my dog. And I flew home to Massachusetts for 10 days, spent 3 days at the FPA conference at the convention center in Boston. And then from there, went down and visited family. But we had a lot of good information that we covered at the FPA convention, some things that I want to bring our listeners up to date on. So that was enjoyable to be there. And, of course, being down at the harbor in Boston and going to a legal seafood harborside every night was was good. And although one day I went to a Chinese... Oh, that's right.
As Jim reaches into his pocket, pulls his wallet out.
Well, I just want you to know...
You brought
a fortune.
A fortune from a fortune cookie.
Yes. Back from Massachusetts. Now, just do the math on how many Chinese restaurants are in Boston. I mean, you can't even begin to imagine. And then how many fortune cookies they must hand out. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Would you not agree, Pete?
I would agree.
So we all know the chances of getting one fortune is slim. I mean, because there's so many going out.
Well, I think there's only about 12.
And some of them are
what?
Different fortunes.
Oh, no, no. There's fortunes for everything. You can go to a restaurant and stay there all week and not get the same fortune cookie. I just want you to know that this fortune that I received, which I have diligently carried around with me, I think speaks volumes.
Is it addressed to you personally, Jim?
It should be.
Okay.
It should actually be addressed, Jim, comma. And then say the rest. I'll let Chris read it on the air on how right this fortune is. And you're also talking to the man who has recently won two baskets and a $50 gift card.
Very nice.
So luck is on his side.
He's a lucky duck.
So you can read my fortune. Not the Chinese side, the other side.
It says come back for seconds.
No, the other side. That side.
Lucky numbers.
No, above the lucky numbers.
I need my reading glasses. This isn't come. It looks like
an eye chart.
Everyone agrees, you are the something, and I can't quite make it out.
I'll let Pete read it.
It's all blurry there at the end. I can't quite make it out.
The other side, please. Not the Chinese side. And above the lucky numbers.
All right. Oh, my goodness. This obviously is a misfortune. Everyone agrees.
A misprint.
Yeah, you are the best.
What was that now? I didn't hear that.
You want me to say it in Chinese? Everyone agrees you are the best.
Thank you.
I think it's, let's just take a poll around the room.
You two are everyone.
We may be everyone in your world, but probably not in Boston.
You're everyone and no one. But I just thought that was a very meaningful and poignant fortune. And Chris is ignoring it.
I think Chris has moved on.
I'm pretty sure that is a misprint of some type.
It wouldn't have been in my cookie.
I think
everyone
on the back
agrees.
It said there was some link to www.printyourownfortunecookiepaper.com or something.
No. That was an actual fortune that I received while home.
Well, you were fortunate to
and
receive
everyone
that.
Everyone agrees you are the best. I just wanted you guys to see that.
Well, everyone at the Cookie Factor obviously does.
Okay, so what I want to chat about, a little thing that came up, I am going next week to the Ed Slott program. And fortunately, it's in Denver, so I don't have to fly anywhere. So I will be out of the office next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and Saturday. Actually, next Wednesday and Thursday, Justin and I are going to a two-day Social Security class. So we're going to be taking a class on Social Security training for 2 days, and then I'm off to the Ed Slott program for another 3 days of IRA training. So next week, it's going to be fill Jim's head with a bunch of stuff. But in this industry, Pete, I think you will agree, we have to constantly be learning.
We do.
So you constantly, not only that, you teach CE credits to advisors and CPAs and attorneys.
Best way to learn.
Best way to learn is to teach. And you also learn, obviously, because you have to learn what you're teaching. So one of the things that I believe vehemently in the office is to constantly go out and learn. So I will be gone next week. I'm looking forward to it. We will be recording on Tuesday of next week. So it'll be a new show for our listeners, but it won't be a live show. We'll be live actually on Halloween, on the 31st.
Right.
So we'll be live on that day. But one of the things I wanted to go over, we had to take our Ed Slott annual exam, and someone who everyone agrees is the best forgot to take his.
Oh, who would that be?
Just someone who shall remain nameless.
Huh.
And received an email from Ed's group saying, hey, you didn't take the annual exam yet. So that person, who again shall remain nameless. Because they are the best.
If they were best, they would have taken the exam, I think.
That would have been prompt. It didn't say prompt, just says you were the best. So that person took said exam.
Mm-hmm. How did that person do?
Aced it.
Wow.
Yes.
They are the best.
They are the best. So that person then gets an email back if they got everything right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the questions in the exam, I thought, I think I really want to talk to my clients about, our listeners about this. So very rarely do we prep for the show. Anybody would know that if they listen long enough. But we did talk about this off camera for a good 5-10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Off radio.
We knew what you meant.
For a good 5 or 10 minutes.
Or 20.
Or 20. Mm-hmm. Making sure we wanted to talk about this or not. And I think we all agree we felt comfortable talking about it. And
it's a little complicated.
It's a little complicated, so I'm going to try to dumb it down. But more importantly, I think there could be a lot of listeners out there who could fall victim to this.
Maybe we should say just make it a little more understandable.
Yes, because it is a very complex case. And what it involves, though, is one particular custodian that is very common or very prevalent, that's the word I'm looking for, in the 403B market, especially with a lot of universities and school systems.
Right, which we have here in Colorado.
Which we have here in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So we'll name this custodian as a heads up for people, but I need to prep a little bit about what we're getting to. And it has to do with moving money from IRAs and retirement accounts after the age of 70 and a half,
mm-hmm.
or more importantly, after the year you reach 70 and a half. So what happens, Chris or Pete, whoever wants to answer this, what happens in the year you turn 70 and a half?
You know, you have to begin taking your required minimum distributions, but you can delay that withdrawal until April 1st of the following year.
Absolutely. So we've talked on many, many shows about RMDs, what they are, how they work. RMD stands for required minimum distribution. In short, you've ticked off the government if you are over the age of 70 and a half and still alive.
That's let's be clear. It isn't that you're alive. It's that you're alive and haven't paid taxes.
There you go.
Yes. They don't care that you're alive.
Right. That's what's upsetting them. It's the taxes part.
Yeah. Right.
Because they have a remedy for the other.
Right. Yeah. So what happens is the government passed a rule that said, look, if you're still alive after 70 and a half and you still have money in tax-deferred accounts such as 401Ks, 403Bs, 457s, IRAs, we're going to force you to take that money out. Mm-hmm. We're sick of waiting. Mm-hmm. So they passed required minimum distribution rules, which years ago used to be very complex. Now they're just mildly complex.
Yes.
They simplified it, but at the same time made them confusing. Yet I will say, compared to the way they used to be prior to simplification in around 97 is when they did it, it was a nightmare. Now it's not too bad. But it's not too bad for you and I, Chris, because we do it all the time. For people who don't do it, they get a little confused. And they get confused because the government has stupid little rules that apply to different accounts. And one of the rules applies to qualified accounts, but not IRAs. So let's explain what that means. One general rule with required minimum distributions, whether or not you have an IRA or a ERISA plan, such as a 401k, is it doesn't matter. In the year you turn 70 and a half, required minimum distribution rules apply to all distributions. So it's not April 1st of the year following. That's when you have to take the first distribution. You have to take the first distribution by April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half.
And just to point out that you also have to take a distribution for that year. That
Correct.
Is the April 1st year. So you're doubling up your distributions if you delay the first distribution to that second
right.
year.
Right. First, you have to take the distribution in the year you turn 70 and a half. They allow, as Pete said, to delay that till April 1st. The operative word there, though, is delay, not avoid. So if you delay it till April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half, in that year you have to take two distributions, the one you delayed and the one for that year. But the rule says in the year you turn 70 and a half. So let's say somebody was going to turn 70 and a half in 2015. Beginning January 1st of 2015, a certain set of rules apply. Doesn't matter if you actually delay that distribution till April 1st of 2016. You are stuck to the rules. And the rules are quite simple. The first dollars to be removed, actually physically taken out and paid to you, the first dollars to be removed is your RMD.
Right.
That's the rule. Now, it does not matter if you delay that first RMD till 2016, in my example, the following year. The first dollars to come out are required minimum distributions. Now, in and of itself, that might not be too bad, but there is a problem. RMDs cannot be rolled over. We're asked that all the time. Remember what a rollover is, people. Rollovers are when you receive money from an IRA or a 401k or something like that. You physically get the money. You can touch it, handle it, play with it, do whatever you want with it. And if you don't put it back in an IRA or other qualified account within 60 days, you will have to pay taxes on it.
Well, just, yeah, go ahead. Right. I know where you're going.
It gets a little confusing because the industry calls them all sorts of different things. But generally speaking, a rollover is when you receive the money. Generally speaking, a transfer, often called a direct transfer, is when you don't receive the money.
And actually, this is where it gets confusing because the technical term is they call it a direct rollover.
Right. It gets really...
So we avoid using that terminology and we call it a direct transfer to make it clear the distinction between what we view as a rollover where you touch the money and then it goes to another account versus it going directly from a custodian to a custodian.
Exactly.
And avoiding your hands completely. So we avoid using the terminology that actually technically is correct.
It is technically correct.
Called a direct rollover. So
I like the word direct and indirect, though.
Yeah.
Direct means it goes directly from one account to another.
Yeah.
Indirect means it goes to you first. You do what you want with it, right, and get it back in an account within 60 days. So I would agree, Pete. Hopefully you would agree. Direct and indirect add clarity. Rollover, transfer, that adds confusion.
I agree, and I'm glad you guys are distinguishing between that, because I get those questions frequently, and the people are talking about rollovers that really aren't rollovers in the technical sense. So it is. It's horribly confusing.
So direct and indirect. But the law is pretty explicit. If you take money out of the account, that is the RMD. RMDs come out first if you take it.
Now, let me, for clarity, though.
Well, even if you don't take it into your own possession, if it just leaves that account, the first money's leaving once you reach 70 in the year that you reach 70 and a half are defined as RMDs.
Yes and no. Depends on the account. We'll get to that in one second.
Okay. But the point of this is that any withdrawals from the account, whether they're moved into another qualified account, into an IRA or what have you, the only time that removal would the RMD rules would apply is when you are forced to take RMD, and that doesn't happen until 70 and a half. So
correct.
69, 68, 70 even, this doesn't even apply
right.
in terms
correct.
Of that. Okay.
Right. So the law goes one step further. Not only does it say all physical dollars, Chris, coming out are the RMDs, the law also says specifically required minimum distributions cannot be rolled over.
Yep.
Okay. So what they're saying, because we're asked that all the time, Pete, I don't need the money. I'm 70 and a half. Can I take it and just put it in an IRA? I'll pay taxes when it goes into the IRA. I just don't need it. I got no place to put it. I'll take it out of one IRA and put it in another. Or sometimes people are smart. They'll say, I'll take it, I'll pay taxes on it, and put it in a Roth. No, you can't do that. Just no, they're on to that. So they say, first dollars out, RMDs. And they also say RMDs cannot be rolled over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we just went to explain, we generally prefer, Chris, rollover to be used to describe when a client physically takes possession of the money, and we prefer to use the word direct or direct transfer when the money moves from one account to the other and the client never touches it. That's how we prefer to word it. The industry is a little convoluted because the government also said in the case of employer plans, not IRAs, but employer plans, all distributions, whether you physically take it or not, whether it goes to you or goes directly to the next custodian, are considered rollovers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said rollovers can't what? Excuse me, RMDs can't what?
Be rolled over.
Be rolled over. And the first money to come out of an account is what? After the age of 70 and a half.
Defined as an RMD.
And RMDs can't be rolled over.
Correct.
And all money moving directly from a 401k to another account is?
Rolled over.
Clear as mud right now?
Very
this
clear.
Is setting up a catastrophe. I'll explain when we come back. I know it's confusing people. I'm going to make this real easy when we come back. I'm going to simplify these rules to explain how many people get burned when it comes taking money out of employer plans. Because remember, no matter what, money coming from an employer plan, 401k, 457, 403b, is always classified as a rollover, even if you don't touch the money. Money coming from an IRA is different. If the money goes directly from one custodian to another, that's called a transfer, a direct transfer.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes to you, it's called a rollover. RMDs have to come out first, as we said, except this is where it gets confusing. In the case of IRAs, IRAs, you can move from one IRA to another without taking the RMD first because you're not touching it. You're not
well,
doing
and you're
rollover.
Not changing it into a different type of an
no,
account.
It's still staying IRA.
It's still staying in what the IRS considers you to have, which is one big giant IRA, even if technically it's broken up into different pieces at different custodians.
You hit the nail on the head.
Right.
All your IRA money is the same to them.
Right. Moving it around among the different buckets you might have inside your IRA, it's still considered in one big giant IRA. When we move from an employer plan to an IRA, that's the difference. That is when you're changing from one account type to another, and the definition or the classification of a rollover happening is where you get caught in what we're setting up here.
Exactly. So we're going to clarify this. What I'm afraid of is that it was, even though we're trying to make it easy, we're probably still making it confusing. But I'm going to give an example when we come back and how people are getting burned by this little known rule. And unfortunately, custodians might be causing the problem.
Certain custodians.
Certain custodians.
Who might be named. We'll see. We'll see how this goes. So this is the Retirement and IRA Show. We're coming up to the second break here. When we come back from this second break, we're going to hear the number one song from 40 years ago this week. So that would be in 1975, the week ending October 18th, which if you're listening live, that would be tomorrow. The number one song from that week is the composer-singer of this song showed musical talent at a very young age, resulting in his being accepted into Juilliard at the tender age of 9.
Oh,
wow, that's pretty young. And we now know it's a he from the hint. So
yes, we do.
He was accepted into Juilliard at the tender age of 9. So we'll find out who that is and what the song is when we come back from this short break on the Retirement and IRA Show. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number one song from 40 years ago this week.
Returning for the second week in a row.
It is returning number one once again, staying at number one from last week, at least last week in 1975. I played it a little bit longer this time so we could actually get to the title of the song,
mm-hmm.
help you guys out a little bit, although I'm pretty sure you remember it from last week. So
I have a really good memory. It's just really short.
So that was Peter. Actually, you nailed this last week.
Well, I got the artist.
You got the artist,
but Jim got the title. Mm-hmm. So it was a team effort.
So how about if we flip it around, Jim? Who's the artist?
Uh-oh.
Neil Sedaka.
Very good.
Nice.
Pull that out.
And the title?
Bad Blood.
Excellent. See, you got, when you change, you know, we flip the pilot, co-pilot seats or whatever, it still works out.
Very nice job, guys. We're trained on both sides of that.
Apparently. So that is Bad Blood, composed and sung by Neil Sedaka. Sedaka was mostly known at this time for feel-good songs, but Bad Blood was a bitter breakup song with controversial lyrics.
Yes, indeed.
Sedaka liked this song specifically because it wasn't a goody-goody two-shoes song.
Well, this one did quite well for him too.
I think this was his biggest hit.
Yeah, that's what you said.
So that's what you said last week. Yeah,
I guess he needed to get angry a little earlier. He was a little too goody-goody two-shoes in his own description.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with a very complicated very complicated
process
and topic.
Topic,
I think, is where I was trying to go. When we left before this last break,
right.
We were describing kind of the minutiae, the details, and the differences behind movement of funds between IRAs, movement of funds between employer-sponsored plans, and particularly once you've reached that magical year, the age you turn 70 and a half, where required minimum distributions begin from almost all of these accounts. We've intentionally left Roths out of the conversation, specifically Roth IRAs, because they aren't subject to RMDs, but Roth 401ks are. just to make the distinction there. So we've got an issue that's kind of boiling now to the surface, Jim, where you said there was a disaster looming.
We did. There's a disaster looming for certain issues, custodians here. But the first way, and Pete asked to mention this, so it was very good, is IRAs, as Chris alluded to in the last segment, doesn't matter how many you have, they can all be considered one big one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you take money physically out of an IRA, the government calls that a rollover. If you transfer money from one IRA to another, never touch it, it just moves electronically or by a check. That is called a direct transfer.
But your rollover, when you take money from the IRA, you're obligated, if you want it to remain a rollover, is to put it back into another IRA within 60 days.
Correct, within 60 days.
Yeah. So just the withdrawal alone has got to have the second step.
Correct.
Okay.
So that we've covered ad nauseum on previous shows.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not treated the same way with employer plans, 401ks, 403bs, 457s. Every movement of assets in an employer plan, whether it goes to you first and then within 60 days back to a retirement account, or directly from one plan to the other, are categorized as rollovers. Whereas in an IRA, it's only a rollover if you take the money. It's a direct transfer if you move the money. In a 401k or a 403b, excuse me, it doesn't matter. It's always classified as a rollover. Why? I have no idea. But that's the rule. I don't make the rules. I just follow the rules. Okay. I also said, once you reach 70 and a half, in the year you turn 70 and a half, RMDs apply, or RMD rules apply. And the rules say any dollars removed from the account will be considered first an RMD. Okay?
That's on the qualified accounts.
Yes.
Employer-sponsored qualified accounts. Yep.
But RMDs cannot be rolled over. That's also in the rule. So you cannot move a 401k to an IRA or a 401k to a 401k at another employer without first taking your RMD, because RMDs cannot be rolled over. Every transfer of money in a 401k is a rollover, and RMDs must be moved first. So you simply have to take your RMD first.
So if I have a 401k and I get upset with my custodian and I'm 71 and I just say, okay, I'm going to fire you guys, move it over here to this new custodian. And I go, now what I'll do is, because it's not the end of the year, so I don't have to take my RMD out yet. So I wait till December after it's moved over to the new custodian and then I pull out my RMD. I'm okay, right?
Negative. Because no. You didn't take the RMD from the original.
First. So I cannot Correct. Move it without taking, even though I want to get rid of this custodian, I cannot right. take my take
and,
the
and
whole
with
thing.
With a 401k, order. You generally can't do that anyway, unless you started working for someone that has a 401k that accepts
All right.
a rollover into it anyway. You're over 70 and a half. The chances yeah. that you're maybe still working. So it's possible. Yeah. I guess what you're saying is possible, but you'd have to take your RMD first.
So let me rephrase it. So 401k, I say, okay, I'm just going to put it in my IRA. I don't want you guys to be managing it for me. I put it into my IRA, and say I do that in September, and I think, well, I'll wait till December before I wait till the longest period because it earns more internally. I'll take my required minimum distribution in December out of my IRA, which was now the recipient of my 401k.
It won't work.
You violated it initially when you moved it to the IRA, which is called a rollover, and you were in the year that you were in the year or later that you turned 70 and a half, you must satisfy the RMD first, and then the balance, whatever's left, can be rolled
The
over.
Good news is most custodians will take the RMD first. They know.
Mm-hmm.
They protect me from myself.
Yes, they yeah. protect you from being
stupid.
Well,
they should be well-versed in the rules
yes.
and help you follow those rules.
So when you move a 401k after the age of 70 and a half, the plan custodian will not move that 401k until you take the RMD. Same thing with 403Bs, 457s. Most of the custodians will force you to take the RMD first, and then you can roll over the rest. Mm-hmm. Because they know, first of all, every transfer of dollars after the age of 70 and a half is considered RMD first. Every movement from an employer plan to another employer plan or an employer plan to an IRA is categorized as a rollover. And the law says RMDs can't be rolled over. So if it's a rollover and an RMD, it can't be moved. It has to be taken first. So I know it sounds confusing because you don't have this same problem with IRAs. IRAs are considered one big IRA. You can move an IRA from one account to another. Some custodians will ask you, do you want to take the RMD first? Some custodians over the age of 70 and a half will ask you if you're moving an IRA in, did you take the RMD or do we have to do this before the end of the year? Employer plans must, by law, send you your RMD whether you ask for it or not. IRAs do not send an RMD unless you ask for it. They give you the option. When mm-hmm. you turn 70 and a half, they ask you, do you want us to set this up automatically and send it to you? You don't have to. Mm-hmm. But an employer plan must send you the RMD every year.
And that's because the employer plans, you have to take the RMD out of that particular plan each year, where with IRAs, if say you had four of them, you could pull all of your required minimum distribution out of one IRA, so you don't have to take them out of each one.
Yes, if you have four IRAs, you only need to take one RMD based on the value of all four IRAs,
right.
But you only have to take the money from one account. You don't have to take a little from each.
Right.
You have four 401ks, you have to take four RMDs. But it gets confusing. Again, I don't make the rules, I just follow them. If you have a 403B or multiple 403Bs, 403Bs can be aggregated just like IRAs and it'll treat it one big 403B. But because it's an employer plan, it doesn't escape that every asset movement from the 403B is a rollover. So it gets confusing. So what happens is this. Remember, when it comes to RMDs from employer plans, all distributions from plans are rollovers, even if the distribution goes directly to another employer plan. The first money out of an employer plan is the RMD and will satisfy the RMD, even if the participant could have waited, as we said before, till April 1st of the following year.
When they turn 70 and a half.
When they turn, well, no.
So after they turn 70 and a half.
Yeah. RMDs cannot be rolled over. Remember that. And employer plans are required to pay out RMDs each year. So with all that understanding, here's what happens that Ed's group wanted to point out to us. And the reason I'm mentioning this now is this was some of the questions on our test that someone recently took late.
Yes, best.
Someone who's the best took it late. And some of the questions had to do with this very confusing topic. But in May, when we were at our Ed Slot program, and for those of you who don't know, Ed Slot is a gentleman who trains financial planners, estate planning attorneys, and CPAs on the many rules of IRAs and 401ks. And I have been in his program for quite some time, about 7 years now, I think. And anyways, I just go there and study and learn. One of the things he wanted to talk about raised a red flag to me because a person I had been working with fell victim to this. And that Ed was describing a case that made my case that I came across look like a cakewalk. So I am going to name the custodian here as a warning to people, because if you have this custodian, you need to know the rules. And the custodian is TIA Cref. TIA Cref is a very fine custodian. I'm not picking on them. Very highly rated insurance company. Very involved in the university and education markets, I guess you could say, and very big in the 403B plan arena. Would you agree on all that?
I agree.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the problems that they do is they have the TIA portion As Ed writes to us, as he was describing this case study, he wrote, one of the restrictions in a TIA CREF account is that participants generally cannot do a lump sum distribution from their TIA portion of the account.
To another custodian? Is that what you're saying?
At all.
Period.
Taking it out to even for yourself.
Yes. Okay. All right. Because the TIA portion is an annuity. Okay. And annuities have all these different rules, Pete. And one of the rules that annuity providers put on them is a restriction on access to your money without penalty. And if you take out your money in a lump sum, they're going to hit you with a steep penalty. Well, a lot of annuities will allow you to take a little out every year, but not everything until the penalty period is satisfied.
So in addition to this being a qualified account and having all the rules you have to follow for that category, it also can be built as an annuity and have extra restrictions on it from the, in this case, insurance company that offers the annuity itself.
Right, because this is a 403B, which is often called a tax-deferred annuity.
Yep.
Correct. So what you have in the case of TIA money, because you have the TIA and you have the CREF side. The CREF side is generally their investment side. So on the TIA side, which as Chris alluded to is the annuity side, and I'm reading from Ed, funds must be moved out via a transfer payout annuity, TPA, which is set up to move funds out over a 10-year period. Mm-hmm. So it takes you 10 years to get at the TIA money out of the TIA CREF side. Now, if all your money is in the CREF side, no problem. CREF side is generally their investment side. But if you're on the annuity side, to get your money out, it generally is set up as a transfer payment annuity and will pay out the account value over the course of 10 years. Right.
And that's if you're opting to do that rather than turn it into a payout annuity.
Correct. You can turn it into a payout annuity or a pension, in other words, at any time and begin receiving income.
Right.
But if you want the actual money in there,
and get it out of there.
That's how they set it up.
Yep.
Okay. They also offer the ability, not the requirement, but the ability to take those transfer payments and put them in an IRA. Mm-hmm. So you're going to take it from a 403B.
Which is deferred, tax deferred.
Right. And you're going to put it in an IRA.
Still tax deferred.
And TIA is very nice about it. And they say, hey, look, we'll set up the IRA for you if you'd like. And they'll set up an IRA at their place and automatically every year move your value, your 10% or your 1/10, because you're going to close this over 10 years, and move it automatically for you into an IRA. Doesn't sound too bad, and it works beautifully.
Sounds pretty clean.
It is, until when?
Until it gets really dirty. Which is the year you turn 70 and a half.
And that's the problem. A couple of years ago, I ran into this problem, and I called up Ed's group, and I spoke with a gentleman there who's not there anymore. His name is Joe. Joe was a great guy. He's from New York, heavy New York accent. Mm-hmm. And I explained the situation of what had happened. And Joe interrupted me. He says, let me guess, TIA. I says, yeah, how'd you know? And he went on to explain to me that they know of this problem for quite some time. And I'm not the first Ed Slott member who brought it to their attention because I needed to know what to do to help my client. Here's what happens. As long as you're not 70 and a half, Pete, moving the money from the 403B to an IRA is no problem. Correct?
Not right. It's a rollover.
It's a rollover.
Moving from this employer-sponsored 403B plan to an IRA, which you're absolutely allowed to do. And since they're both tax-deferred accounts, there's no tax consequence for that movement. Ultimately, when the money comes out of the IRA, it will be taxed. But the movement from the 403B to the IRA, totally allowed, normal thing, happens every day of the week.
Exactly. And remember what I also said. The government considers the movement of all money from an employer plan to be RMD first.
Well, no, to be a rollover.
Well, it's an RMD first, but it's also a rollover.
Only if they've reached 70 and a half.
But it is an RMD. Once you reach 70 and a half, the movement of all money is considered an RMD first. Mm-hmm. So what happens prior to 7.5 is no problem with what TIA is doing. I have no problem with it. So if somebody has this set up already and you're listening thinking, oh gosh, I have one of these transfer payment annuities moving 1/10 of my 403B into an IRA, don't worry about it if you're under the age of 70.5. But in the year you turn 70.5, here's the problem. TIA's computer system will continue to move the money from the 403B to the IRA. Now, that's the issue because what happens is you have to physically take your RMD first before you move money, because all money coming from an employer plan after the age of 70.5 is considered RMD first. All movement of employer money is considered to be a rollover. Rollover RMDs cannot be rolled over. So you have these two double negatives hitting almost. So what happened to the person I was with and to the person Ed writes about is when they turned 70.5, that money kept going from the 403B to the IRA. And that created a problem. The problem was not a missed RMD. The RMD was taken because the first money to come out of an employer plan is always classified as RMD. The problem was the RMD did not go to the person, Pete, as cash. It went into the IRA. So the IRS considers that to be an illegal contribution. RMDs cannot be moved to an account. They have to be taken. So when you put money into an IRA that shouldn't have been put in, they call that a excess contribution. Or any, I don't really want to use the word illegal. You're not going to go to jail over it.
It's excess.
It's an excess contribution.
In this case, you're not allowed to put any in because you're over the age of 70.5.
Correct.
So any amount you put in that you're not allowed to is an excess of the allowed. So in this case, even a dollar would be too much.
So Ed writes about a gentleman who turned 70.5 in 2008. In 2009, TIA set up a transfer payment annuity for him, moving money from his 403B to his IRA. He was already over the age of 70.5, Pete, and they did this. And what happens, now, you might think initially, oh, goodness, he's going to get hit with a 50% penalty tax because he never took his RMD. This went on from 2009 to 2015 before his advisor, who happens to be in the Ed Slot Group, picked up on it, brought it to Ed's attention, and they had to clear this whole mess up. So Ed went on to say, no RMDs were missed. There is no 50% penalty. That's the penalty for missing an RMD. The RMDs were taken. Why? The first money to come out of an employer plan is considered to be the RMD. So the IRS didn't dispute that the RMDs were taken. They were. The problem was they were put into an IRA, and that's against the law. RMDs cannot be rolled over. You have to take them physically. So this created 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, 7 years of excess contributions into an IRA. That was the issue. The other money in, because your RMDs begin at about 3.6% of the account value. Remember, they moved 10. So let's call it 3.5% to keep a round number here. 6.5% of the money going into the IRA could be a legal rollover. 3.5% of the money was considered an excess contribution. Excess contributions are subject to 6% penalty taxes every year you leave the money in. Can you see how this got ugly? 7 years he's been doing this. Every excess contribution is subject to a 6% penalty tax. Not only that, once the excess contribution stays in the IRA for greater than 1 year, the excess contribution can stay in the IRA, but what has to happen?
All of the earnings have to come out.
Exactly. So they had to go back and figure out every year.
I take it back. It's the reverse, Jim.
Oh, I wasn't paying attention.
What was what has to come out is the amount that was put in there. The earnings can stay.
Correct. The earnings can stay.
That's what makes it a little more complicated. So it's not even just there's now you have to split it into two pieces.
Right. So for any distribution more than 1 year old, the excess amount has to, or the excess amount can stay in there, but the earnings, excuse me, now I'm saying it the way you said it. See how confusing this is, people? So once the excess contribution has stayed in for more than a year, the excess amount
has to come out.
Has to come out. The earnings gets to stay in. Mm-hmm. So they had to do a calculation in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13. Not the 2014 one. It hadn't been in there for a full year yet. They had to go back and do calculations, Pete. They had to figure out what had to stay in the 403B, what had to come out, what had to be declared as income, what couldn't. For the last 2 years, the entire excess had to be removed because it hadn't reached that one-year period yet. Why I mention this, I don't expect people to follow this. I expect people to, if you have TIA CREF and they have set you up with a transfer payment annuity from your 403B to an IRA and you are approaching the age of 70 and a half.
Or you're over.
Watch out. Now, TIA will say we disclosed that to people. And they did. You can't see what I'm looking at here, but it's the disclosure in the actual size print Ed put in there. And it says, it's about an 8-point font, and it was item 12 on the disclosure document. And I'll read that when we come back, because TIA does make it perfectly clear in 8-point font, item 12, on your disclosure document, that what they're doing is pretty much wrong.
Sounds reasonable. Yeah,
so they know they're doing it
wrong. As long as you admit it, it's fine, right?
Yeah.
So
that's the first step, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Not to be in denial anymore, right?
Yes.
The first step is admitting you have a problem. So this is the Retirement and IRA Show. We got kind of deep in the woods on that one, but I think the takeaway is be on the watch out if you have TIAA CREF and one of these 403Bs. When we come back from this next break, we're going to hear the number one song from 1980 or 35 years ago. The hint is it's often used by wrestlers and boxers as their entrance song. It is also used when the basketball team, the Chicago Bulls, win a home game.
Let's get ready to rumble?
No. Nice guess.
No, that's when they lose.
So we'll figure out what that is when we come back from this short break on the Retirement and IRA Show. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number one song once again this week. From 1980, it's the third and final week.
Is it? Oh, okay.
Give your people a tease for next week. There's no duplicate on the number one song from 1980. Next week, this is the final week. That is, of course, Another One Bites the Dust by Queen. Everybody, I think, recognizes that song.
Yep,
so
sure.
We don't need to guess on that one at all.
That was the same one last week.
That's kind of what I just said.
Oh, I wasn't paying attention. I was looking at
this is the third and final week. Yeah, the week before that it was as well. That's what third means.
Yes, and this is the second.
There were
incident.
two weeks prior to the third, which is this.
Yeah, and twice now today, right. Jim hasn't been paying attention.
It's all good. So I'm excited for next week
because we got a new song.
Because we'll have a new song, but this brings us to the segment on the show where we get an update on what's new at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. And in
we don't
a moment,
have the song.
We have the song. We just don't have the volume for the song.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, we discuss having Social Security benefits in combination with a military pension. We answer a question. that a reader or listener sent to us. I'm not sure exactly which, because when I get to them, they've already been filtered through a couple of places. But we were sent a question about if a person would be subject to the WEP or GPO provisions of Social Security if they had a military pension. And
the short answer?
And the short answer is no, they are not. And we also have some other good news that are shared in that blog for people receiving a military pension. Some bonuses that a person receives for having military service during certain years. And it gets into some heavy detail, so I'll leave that to the blog post. But if you think if you fall into that category where you've got a military pension for active military duty, as well as Social Security from work in the private sector, the post this week I think will be of great interest to you. So that is on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, and that's what's new this week.
What's new, pussycat?
Wow, you're going to make people go read it.
Yeah.
Or listen. I recorded the topic as well. But it's highly detailed. There's years involved, numbers, dollars.
They'll want to take notes.
Plus, I'm waiting with bated breath to hear about TIAA's solution to this problem that they seem to be participating in themselves. So this is a problem somewhat created by what normally would be their position would be to help you avoid breaking the rules. It appears that they're doing the opposite here.
Right, and I think that's what upset Ed the most on this. The gentleman set it up after reaching 70 and a half. Mm-hmm. And
before you do that, though, you promised us you were going to read the disclosure.
That's what I'm getting to.
Awesome.
So
I can't see it from here.
Well, it's too small.
I can't read it either. I got readers on, so Ed wrote it bigger down here.
Okay.
But TIA knows this is a problem because they write on 8-point font, box 12 or section 12 of their disclosure form. Section, I don't know how many sections there are, but this is buried in 12. If and it's set up as a Q&A. So it says, if my annual transfer payout annuity payment is rolled over or directly transferred to an IRA, does this satisfy the required minimum distributions rule? Answer, no. Rollovers and direct transfers do not satisfy IRS rules for required minimum distributions. Next question. In addition to taking a distribution from the IRA or retirement plan that received... Oh, excuse me. That was part of the following answer. It wasn't a question. So they write, in addition, taking a distribution from the IRA or retirement plan that received your TPA payment does not satisfy the IRS rules either. And then they went on to say, if you have any questions or want to learn more about ways to satisfy your required minimum distributions, please call us. And they gave the phone number. What upset Ed is they never reached out to this man. They know what he's doing isn't going to work. It's not going to satisfy the rules. And they're saying, call us. Rather than pointing out to him ahead of time, all this could have been avoided if one simple thing was done. The RM, they're allowing you to take 10% of the account out, or 1/10 of the account out a year, because this account could be closed over the course of 10 years. Mm-hmm. All what they had to do, Pete, was send the RMD as
him.
Cash as mm-hmm. him, and the rest put into the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
All that could have been avoided. That's the issue I ran into, mm-hmm. and that's why I'm mentioning this.
And they've been asked to do that very thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And their
because
answer?
What happened with the person I was working with is they came into my office, this was last year, wanted me to review RMDs, and I saw this thing happening exactly as described. This gentleman had set up his transfer payment annuity before turning 70 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the person Ed's talking about did it the year after turning 70 and a half. But this person who came to talk to me 3 years before turning 70 and a half set this up.
Mm-hmm.
So when I reviewed his RMD issue, I saw the movement. Once he turned 70 and a half, I'm sitting there looking and say, wait a minute. They can't be moving from a 403B to an IRA. He's now 70 and a half. He's got to take the RMD first. So we reached out to TIA and they admitted, oops, it was a mistake. So I said to this person, can we just send in the future so we don't have this happen, Can you just send the RMD to the person directly and put the rest in the IRA? No.
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 No, can't be done. Can't
no.
do it.
Nope.
Well, they refuse to do it, right?
It can be
technically
done.
It could be done.
It's legal to do it. There's nothing wrong
by
with
a company
it.
Who's willing to do it, right? There's nothing preventing them from doing this other than their own choice not to.
Or the technology isn't quite there.
Well, that's
I don't know.
They've chosen to embrace technology that won't allow this.
Because the person I was working with wasn't trying to dispute taking 10 years to access his money. That wasn't the problem. The issue is, once he reached 70 and a half, he had to physically take the RMD first.
So, Jim, the moral of this story is that if you're going to withdraw the funds from the TIA account and they only allow you to do it over 10 years, you better make sure you start it before you turn 70 and a half. Otherwise, you're going to run into this problem within that 10-year frame.
Well, hopefully they're going to fix it someday.
I guess you might, maybe, and I don't think we talked about this off air, so correct me if I'm wrong, but let's say he redirected the entire 10% to himself. He could keep the part that's an RMD and 60-day roll over the rest of it into the IRA, could he not?
He could, and that's another option to do. Take the money. However, you have to watch that 60-day RMD rule. It's one per account per, excuse me, one per taxpayer now per year. And the distributions were set to be done automatically.
Yeah, and the other problem is they're going to withhold.
Yes,
coming out of the
withholdings 403B. Would come, 20% withholdings. But you could have physically taken all the money, kept the RMD, and did a 60-day rollover on the difference.
The point is they're making you jump through hoops. They're making you do one of two things. Jump through hoops that you don't need to be jumping through and causing excess complexity to this situation. Or worst case, they're helping you break the rules by sending that money without sending the RMD to you, by putting the whole 10% over into this IRA. That is clearly breaking the rules for IRAs.
It is, and I think that's what upset me when I saw this and Ed's group and why he finally wrote about it in our last meeting, because the fact that this gentleman was already over the age of 70 and a half, and they set this up. And they had to have known at that point he has to take the RMD first. This is not an IRA where you can do the transfer even after the age of 70. On an employer plan, you can't. You have to physically take the RMD first.
Well, they said as much in their disclosure.
Yes. So they told them in 8 point, literally 8 point font. That I mean, does that look like 8 point font to you? I don't know. It looks like 8 point font to me.
Let me get out the calculator and the
that's 8 point.
Ruler.
It's tiny.
It is fairly tiny, yes.
So they disclose here that, yeah, they know they can't do it, but nobody told this guy. And now he had to go 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 and fix it. And it's a nightmare. And he had to hire someone who knew what they were doing. So I don't know who he hired. I would assume Ed's group or someone. But Ed knew an awful lot about this to write. And then when I called, and they knew right away the custodian. I didn't even name the custodian. He said, let me guess, TIA Cref. I says, yeah, how did you know? He said, because they've been doing this for a long time. Now, the way the person I was working with got around it, here's what the person did. I wanted to... You couldn't move it, as we were saying.
Because of the restriction, just a reminder,
correct.
Only you have to stretch it out after over 10 years. You couldn't just take it all at once.
Right. So he, the TIA did give him the option to annuitize his 403B. Annuitize is when you turn it into, you no longer have access to the money. The money's gone. It becomes TIA's. And instead, they give him an income stream for the rest of his life. Well, he just so happens to have wanted more income. And part of the reason he was coming in was to help determine how best to get the most income for his money. He wasn't wanting to do investments anymore. He just wanted guaranteed income for the rest of his life, no matter how long him and his wife lived. So what we did is we simply got a quote from TIA, and it was a very good quote. So I'm going to throw out the red carpet to them there. It was a very good quote. We couldn't come, I wouldn't say anywhere close. We came close, but no insurance company that we could find offered more income than TIA was willing to give them. So the point was easy. I said, annuitize that one. And
that's what he did.
I told him it's fairly straightforward what you want to do. You either have to work with TIA and decide what you want to do. He did call me later and say, here's what I decided to do, Jim. I did tell TIA to annuitize that 403B, and that's what he did.
And now he's not taking the spread out 10% per year thing. He's just receiving the income from the annuity, and by doing that, he's satisfying the RMDs for that account, and this issue is now avoided moving forward.
Right, but for those people who didn't want the lifetime stream of income, that was not a suitable option.
Yep.
So your other option is to take 10% out, or one-tenth of the account value, rather, out every year physically to you, even though the RMD amount is a lot less than that. It doesn't have to go to an IRA. It could go to a taxable account. He just couldn't move it all in a lump sum. Very confusing situation here, without a doubt. And I apologize to people who got bored. It's a very confusing conversation we're trying to have, because you really need to see the numbers and see it all drawn out for you.
But it can have a significant impact on people who are participating in TIAA. Account and wanting to move the money to an IRA or even another custodian if that's permitted. So for the people that it applies to, which are quite a few in Colorado, it's a heads up for them to be aware of this.
It's a heads up to see if it's going to apply to you. It's not to say all of them will, and we're not throwing TIA under the bus. When they do things good, they do them really good. But this one is a mistake. And again, the one that upset us the most is, again, as Ed wrote at the beginning, this is a 5-page case study he did for us. The gentleman turned 70 and a half in 2008. That's what irked him, because he set this up in 2009.
Yep. So even that very first year, it wasn't like it was okay for a while and then went bad.
In the
this
case
was
that
bad
right.
right out of the gate. At least exactly. The case you ran into, they set it up at a time
when it was
where
okay.
It would have been okay, but they should have warned the person coming up in three
they
or four
did.
Years.
They warned him in box 12 in 8-point font.
Oh, well, yeah. That's, I mean, a little more direct warning.
Well,
than
but
that.
No, they did warn him.
Yeah,
the disclosure was given in writing. It just wasn't given to him over the phone. It was given to him in box 8 and 8-point font that, hey, this is going to kind of blow up. But what really appalled in this case was the gentleman was already past the point of no return, where it should have been explained to them, hey, we have this rule. You can't get at this account in a lump sum. You got to take it in the course of 1/10. This could have been avoided if he had another 403B. He could take RMDs from that 403B to satisfy this 403B's RMD. We never talked about that possible solution. Mm-hmm. Remember what we said earlier, listeners. IRAs are considered one big IRA, are they not, Chris?
They are.
Okay. 401Ks cannot. You have four 401Ks, Pete. You have to take four RMDs. You have four 457 plans, you have to take four RMDs. You have four IRAs, you got to take one RMD based on four IRAs, but just one RMD. Well, if this person would have had two 403Bs, he could have said to the, and if one of them didn't have this restriction on it, he could have said, look, I want my RMD taken from 403B1. 403B2, yes, transfer it to
the IRA.
But the RMDs would have had to have been sent first.
So timing-wise, there's
timing
an issue.
Would have been important. So that could have avoided some of this issue. But it shouldn't be this difficult. You shouldn't have to know all these complex rules just to move money. The custodian needs to share with people and say, hey, look, we're going to run into an issue, though. You're over the age of 70 and a half, and we have to do RMDs, and essentially our computer's not going to allow it. That's what it comes down to, I think, Pete. I don't think the computer system allows it.
Well, get a new computer.
Well, yeah, some new software.
Right.
So anyways, we just kind of wanted to throw this out as a red flag. We're not looking to throw TIA under the bus. I'm not telling you to take your money from them. I know a lot of teachers love TIA, and they would, it's abhorrent for them to take it anywhere. But just recognize if you are in one of these 403Bs under the TIA side, and they set you up as this transfer payment annuity, they call it, where you, they will close that account over the course of 10 years. If you are not taking that money outright and just paying taxes on it, if you are moving it to another employer plan or to an IRA, you're going to run into this problem when you reach 70 and a half. Maybe by then they'll fix their system where they'll give you the RMD as cash and move the rest to the IRA, which would solve all this. But if they don't, you're going to run into a problem.
Yep.
That's all we're trying to say.
And said very well.
Yeah, right. Over the course so of
whether
two
it,
shows.
I'd say whether it be this kind of complexity or this sort of issue, these little landmines happen more often than you might think. Whether it be dealing with protection and transfer of assets in the estate planning arena, mm-hmm. or whether it be managing and manipulating and moving money between retirement accounts of all these different kinds, or taking distributions from these accounts, or putting money into these accounts, which is really one of the issues that ran, you know, we ran into here. Your money was being put in when it wasn't allowed, so it isn't always about taking money out when you're not allowed. You can put, you can make a mistake putting money in, which can cause a giant headache. That's what we're here for. Right, we're here to reveal right. this, to pull back the veil.
If anybody has a TIA account and they're wondering if this applies to them, and you listen to the show 16 times over and you still can't make heads or tails out of it, give us a call. So, again, if you're in the Northern Colorado area, we do offer coffee and a second opinion where you can meet with us in person and we'll actually make you your coffee. Or you can give us a call from any place you are, and we'll hold the coffee and a second opinion over the phone. And we do offer that. It's complimentary. Now, of course, if you're an iTunes listener, we call them iTunians.
Yeah.
Yeah. iTunians.
You coined that iTunes-ers. Phrase, that name, and I kind of like it.
You like iTunians?
iTunian, yeah.
iTunian. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you're an iTunian in another state, we can't make you the cup of coffee. That's the only thing. Now, I'll mail you a coffee pot if you want, shove it in your own Keurig, and have your free cup of coffee, or you can make your own coffee and just chat with me. But if you are in the Northern Colorado area, you can come into our office right here in Fort Collins. We do offer a complimentary visit, and I can better explain a lot of these issues. And just because you have a TIA account doesn't mean you have a transfer payment annuity. It doesn't mean any of this applies to you. This is just one small part of a very large custodian. TIA is a massively huge custodian. So we're only talking about one small part of their business model. But if you're wondering if this applies to you, and you are over the age of 70 and a half, you could run into some issues. So you can just go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Click on the Contact Us button, and you can set up a time for us to hold a coffee and a second opinion. And Pete, I know if people have questions on estate planning and asset protection and other issues, they can reach out to you as well.
They can, and they can reach me on a similar vein on the web at peterscotthelps.com. That's PETERSCOTTHELPS.com. That will take you to my webpage, and you can reach me there. I'm with the law firm of Cohen, Payton, and Payne. The firm itself does real estate, copyright, trademarks, business transaction, business planning, and I myself limit the practice to estate planning, business succession, business transactions, and tax. So the other way to reach us is the old-fashioned way, over the telephone, and our Greeley number is 970-339-3500. That's 970-339-3500.
Excellent.
So, Jim, do you have an old-fashioned phone, too?
Yeah, we have phones here.
You have a really old-fashioned phone on the wall.
I do. Oh, yeah. My grandfather's phone from the 1920s is on the wall. Mm-hmm.
We still haven't wired that up, so we'll be speaking to you on a more modern device.
Yes.
which amazes me, because people see that. It's one of the old wooden phones that you would see in the old Andy Griffith shows.
Yeah.
You know, and they turn the little crank and try to talk to the operator by hitting up and down on the thing that the crank is held to. I don't know what it's all called. So a lot of people see that, And the funny thing is that was from the 1920s. So it's about 95 years ago. And then I take out my iPhone and I put it on the wall next to it. And I say, you know, we look at this today and laugh. 100 years from now, there's going to be someone's office and one of these iPhones is going to be up on the wall. And they're going to be, oh, my God, that's how they did the phone back then? But right now, it's just this big wooden box. It's pretty neat. I like it.
Yeah.
But it's my grandfather, so I like it even more. And under it is carnival glass that he got in the 1920s and 30s when you went to carnivals. You were given glass when you went in. It's called carnival glass. So that bowl is called carnival glass.
I've heard of carnival glass, but I didn't...
The bowl under the phone. The phone is on the wall. There's a table, and there's a bowl there. The bowl is carnival.
I've never noticed the bowl. What's in the bowl?
Nothing. It's carnival glass.
Probably why you didn't notice it. There's nothing.
So you went. There's no candy in it. So
they went to the you went to the carnival and they handed you as like a parting gift.
It's kind of like the free toaster you used to get at banks. You got carnival glass to go to a carnival.
What?
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't the prize for winning the knocking the.
I don't know. I was under the impression you got it just merely for going in, but maybe he won it there. And I do have some of his carnival glass. And then next to it is a bottle, a green bottle, mm-hmm. that we actually found in a field that my great aunt, named T.T. Stella.
Used to go drinking in the field?
Yeah.
Back then, trash was thrown out. Even when we renovated this house was built in 1905, when they would dig in the expansion, they dug up the trash pits a few times. And because there was no trash service back then. They went out into fields or parts of the house, or parts of the yard, and burned trash. So we found some trash pits here, but we found a trash pit in T.T. Stella's yard, and I have a bottle on the table next to that. So I just think it's pretty neat.
I'm going to pay more attention when I leave.
Yeah, this is like a living museum here at the office.
Gee, thanks for noticing.
Well, I noticed the phone, and I guess I'll probably notice the bowl when I go out there. I didn't realize it.
And the bottle from T.T. Stella's trash pit.
Well, if you put candy in it, Chris probably would pay closer
attention. Yes,
true.
If I had it filled with candy, he'd be all over it. Yes.
Skittles and M&M's. I'd know every intricate nook and cranny of that bowl. So thanks for everybody for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show. We'll be back next week. Next week's going to be another pre-recorded show, the next live show. If you want to call in live for your chance to get in as an entry to the free pie drawing, that will be on October 31st, Halloween. We'll have a Halloween
No, that's the following
show.
Week.
I know. That's what I said. Next week, we're pre-recorded. Oh. The next live show is October 31st on Halloween.
And we'll have the top three Halloween-themed songs of all time.
Well, we're going to work on that.
As measured by Jim Solomon and Associates and Peter Scott.
Exactly. We'll see. So thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show. We'll see you again next week.
Like what you just heard? Missed some of today's show? Listen again on iTunes or the retirementandiraShow.com.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.